about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rick Kustich, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Great Lakes steelhead on the fly. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you to sign up to receive our announcements so that you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is property of the Knowledge Group Inc. doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rick Kustich about Great Lakes steelhead. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle, comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Before we introduce Rick, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the section under Rick's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a copy of Rick's most recent book, which is Advanced Fly Fishing for Great Lakes Steelhead, courtesy of Stackpole Books, and a beautiful 8.5 by 11 book with lots of gorgeous pictures in it and lots of straightforward information. So if you'd like to win that, here's how you win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be something about something that Rick and I talk about during the show. So submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. And do it fast, because the first person that gets the correct answer in wins a copy of Rick's book, Advanced Fly Fishing for Great Lakes Steelhead. Tonight our guest is Rick Kustich. Rick is a fly fishing author and photographer. In January 2013, he released Advanced Fly Fishing for Great Lakes Steelhead, which is his fifth fly fishing title. Rick's work has appeared in numerous national and regional publications. He's also a fly tire, seminar speaker, and travel host, and has produced a fly tying DVD. Rick has also spent time as a fly shop owner, outfitter, and fly fishing book publisher. Rick began fly fishing almost 40 years ago on the lakes and streams of upstate New York. He has since traveled extensively to experience the finest fly fishing throughout North America and beyond, but continues to find that some of the best fishing often exists in your own backyard. Rick spends a significant amount of time each year on the water and has developed a special passion for steelhead fishing in the Great Lakes and British Columbia. Rick, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, Roger. How are you doing tonight?
Good, good. Good to have you on board here.
Yeah, good to be here.
Yeah. Okay. Just to make sure, somebody could just type in the text box on our homepage and let me know that you can hear me. I'd appreciate it. We get started here. Saw something unusual in my console and make sure everybody can hear us. So hold on just a second, Rick.
Okay.
Looks like people can hear us. Yes. Yes. Okay, good. All right. Let's start from the top. Now, we've done, Rick, other shows on steelhead, but they've all been, you know, having to do with Pacific Northwest, British Columbia, and so forth. So this is the first one we've done on the Great Lakes. We have done a show on big brown trout in New York once, And but that's kind of the extent of it. So this is kind of new territory for us, and lots of stuff to talk about, it looks like, considering like you've got five mini-oceans there to deal with. So we've got five lakes that comprise the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan, Lake Erie, Lake Superior, Huron, and Ontario. Now, did they all offer steelhead fishing?
Yes, they do. Right? And each of them have a significant number of tributaries feeding into them. So they all offer, fishing for both wild and hatchery fish. So there's natural reproduction in all five of the lakes as well.
Okay. Now, can you kind of give us a brief history on how the steelhead got there, got established?
Yeah, so, steelhead are, native to the West Coast, Pacific Coast. So, like you've said, you've had shows on Pacific steelhead before. It's their native range. In the late 1800s, specifically about 1875, U.S. Fish and Game Service started to redistribute species of fish throughout the country, and it's kind of went along with, the expansion of railroads. So in about 1875, as part of a plan to bring some of the, rainbow trout from the West Coast to the East, some eggs arrived right here in New York State at the Caledonia Hatchery. And that was kind of the birthplace of steelhead in the Great Lakes region. Those eggs then were, distributed to some of the other lakes. And by the late 1800s, there was, anecdotal stories of natural reproduction of steelhead in all five of the Great Lakes by that time.
Wow. Okay. So it took on rather well to begin with, right?
Yeah, and it's a pretty rich history if you think back to 1875. In terms of, even when I was growing up, I kind of thought of steelhead being, a fairly new introduced species to this region. But, 1875, actually, steelhead were in the Great Lakes actually prior to brown trout being in the United States. So, there's a fairly rich history there.
It's amazing what they could do with milk cans on trains and wagons.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. And just really the hatchery that the original eggs were brought to is still in existence here in New York State. And they have a nice little, small kind of museum area in the hatchery that they have some old pictures and things like that from that time period. And it is really interesting how it all started.
Yeah. Now there's kind of a part two to this, isn't there? More recently with the advent of pollution and bait fish and things like that, can kind of brief us.
Yeah, so really the steelhead and the Great Lakes have really kind of come in two waves. So there was this initial stocking of fish that established these pockets of naturally reproducing steelhead, and there was continued to be some hatchery influence through the early 1900s, but for the most part what established itself as wild fish kind of sustained then through the first half of the 1900s. And basically what happened is, and particularly in the lower lakes, so, Lake Michigan, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, because of different chemicals that were being dumped into the lakes, and mainly one of them was phosphate from detergents, it created an out-of-balance situation with the nutrient level in the lakes. And what that did is it kind of redistributed, the food chain, and created a situation where, there was almost too much nutrition in the lakes and kind of made an out-of-balance situation with bait fish. So that in the late 1960s, things have become so out of balance, there just wasn't predators in the chain, and some of the natural predators, walleye and lake trout, had kind of really fallen off the map because of the lakes being so out of balance. So the idea was then to bring some, kind of another wave of fish from the Pacific. And it really was initially, coho and Chinook salmon, and steelhead kind of followed again in the early 1970s, where really there was a push in all five of the Great Lakes to, particularly again, the lower lakes, to stock steelhead. And that second wave really is what has created much of the fishery that, we enjoy today.
Now, are steelhead being stocked nowadays, or is it all wild?
Yeah, there's still a significant amount of stocking done by all the states, but I think the thing that's probably occurred in the last 10 to 15 years is that fisheries managers have, and maybe 20 years, have become more astute in terms of how to manage steelhead, and where natural reproduction can occur, most states in the province of Ontario are managing those populations in that way, and then are generally just stocking rivers that don't have the capability for natural reproduction, or where there's just limited capability for natural reproduction. A number of rivers in the Great Lakes that have high water quality that can produce, salmon, naturally. But there's others that, over the years, either because of dams or agriculture or, development along those rivers, they get a little too warm in the summer, or maybe don't have the, the proper, gravel for, natural reproduction, or the fish can't get to those areas because of dams. And in those situations, those rivers have to be augmented or, in stock to get some level of return in them.
And so now things are back in balance?
Yeah, things are always, fisheries are always kind of in a, state of change. There was probably a point where it went the other direction, where there was probably, the lower lakes, Erie, particularly Michigan and Ontario, kind of went through this situation in, I'd say the mid-90s, where, the Chinook salmon created such a demand, particularly from a lake fishing standpoint, that, there was such demand to fish for them that the stockings kind of increased to a point where it started to deplete the bait fish populations. And, at that point, it seemed like it put a limitation on the both numbers and size of, both the salmon and the steelhead that they were producing. So I think there's been some cutbacks, I know that there's been cutbacks since then to, again, try to draw things back to more of a balanced situation. So there's been cutbacks in salmon stockings. Actually, in Lake Erie, they don't stock any salmon any longer. And, so we've seen, again, the steelhead populations seem to, react to that and get strong again in the late 1990s and early 2000s. But once again, I think some of the lakes right now, are particularly Lake Erie, are showing that maybe it's not producing the same number of fish that it did even 5 or 10 years ago.
Are the salmon reproducing naturally as well? Or?
Yes, they do. Salmon reproduce naturally in Ontario, Michigan, even here in New York. We have a strong reproduction on a couple of the rivers.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned possible decline on Lake Erie. There was a question from John in Newark, Delaware. He asked that. I've been fishing for many years, I think, on Lake Erie tributary, which has declined over the past few years. Is it your belief that this is a significant broad trend, or is this an isolated or random variation related to weather?
It does seem to be, this is something that I think has been recurring. Again, if you look at numbers and returns of fish in the late 1900s and, the turn of the century, there was incredible returns on Lake Erie tributaries, particularly along, what we refer to as the Steelhead Alley. So it's, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York. And even at that time, the returns that we were even, a lot of it had to do with the number of fish that were being stocked. It was still just, incredible returns and incredible numbers. And even at that time, I thought that just seemed, any time a fishery gets to a point where it seems unbelievable, then, too good to be true, then it usually is, at least in terms of. So, there was a lot going on, I think, in those years that just made it, off the charts good. So, I think we have a tendency to try to compare to those years. But that being said, the last 3 or 4 years, at least here, particularly here in New York State, the Lake Erie tributaries have not been probably producing what, we would like to see. And it's hard to say exactly what the cause of that is. One tributary in particular, though, I think there has been in terms of balance, an increase in the number of walleye in Lake Erie. And I suspect that, there's opportunities for walleye to park out in front of tributaries when, the smolts are moving out into the lake and, use them as part of their diet. So I do think that there has been some correlation there. And I think they're one of the rivers here in New York, Cattaraugus Creek, they've even had some walleye programs on the lower part of the creek to try to, improve the walleye population in that part of the lake. And I do think that there's a correlation there, that, there's a limitation in the survival of the smolts because of predation from walleye.
There must be some big walleye there, then.
Yeah, there is. There's some good walleye fishing in the lake here. But, that's one theory. The fact that the forage base is constantly in flux, I think, we've gone through situations where 10 or 15 years ago we had the zebra mussel introduced into the Great Lakes and it really seemed to flourish in Lake Erie. I thought that was going to have a detrimental impact on steelhead. It didn't seem to. The latest invasive species in Lake Erie is the round goby. Everybody thought that was going to have a significant influence, a negative influence, and the smallmouth seemed to be flourishing, and, they're seemed to be eating the goby and growing to significant sizes. But, maybe that's has somehow changed the feeding patterns or habits of the steelhead. And so there's those constant changes in the lake that something right now just isn't, kind of firing on all cylinders when it comes to the returns.
Yeah, but it's not something that's blatantly apparent, evidently. So
no, I don't think it's blatantly apparent.
Sometimes fisheries go through ebbs and flows, too, So.
Yep, it's just what it is. I don't think it's anything that's, any one direct factor, and I don't think it's anything that, won't change. Every year, I would be hopeful that, we'll start to see increased numbers. And I think even this past year, I think we saw more fish than we did the year before. And, that trend could continue upwards as well. So, I don't think it's anything systemic. I think, it's just a cycle that, I think will balance itself out again.
What is the general health of the lakes? Some healthier than others? By that, I mean not the steelhead per se, but the lake itself.
I think they're all, they're all in much better shape than they were 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Obviously, the further north you go, the less impact they've had from humans and pollution. And, if you get up into Lake Superior, there's some very, pure areas and wilderness areas up there that haven't, suffered much from man's input. Same thing with the upper parts of Lake Huron. Still some very pure areas up there. But I think that, the overall, health of the lakes, and certainly the, not that I, eat much out of the lakes, but just, in terms of the warnings that have existed in the past about consumption, some of those have certainly been reduced over the years. And, I just think that there's been a just general flushing out of some of the, nasty elements that existed 15, 20 years ago. And I think in some of the deeper lakes, like Lake Ontario, it's just taking a longer period of time to kind of fully flush out the, some of the, nasty things that were, in the water.
Yeah.
But I think generally, I think they're in good shape. If you see the clarity in Lake Erie on a, a summer day, we can go out in Lake Erie and you can see the bottom, a lot of times 20, 25, 30 feet deep. And, so.
Good, good. Well, Rick, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back and talk about where we think the best steelhead fishing might be in the Great Lakes. So stick with us, folks, and we'll be right back. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's www.keeney.com, K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Kustich about Great Lakes steelhead on the fly. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show today. Okay, Rick, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world. So what is going on?
Well, I, we're in terms of steelhead fishing, we're kind of at the end of our steelhead cycle or steelhead year. There's still probably about another maybe month, depending on how the weather goes. my focus is starting to change a little bit to trout fishing. I enjoy, you know, April and May trout fishing here in New York State and in Pennsylvania. Hendrickson should be coming off soon, so I'm excited about that. And I do have another book project that I'm going to be embarking on soon, and kind of a little early to talk about all the details, but something I'm going to be doing some fair amount of research on, you know, in the upcoming year with respect to that.
Sure, Rick. I mean, you're going to go fishing for the next
year. Yeah, research.
I've heard that before, research. That's what you tell the wife and family, and right?
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Do you have a website that people
I do. It's rickkostich.com, and you know, books are available there. Some of my I have samples of some of my writing and photography, and you know, an ability there to contact me if anybody would have any specific questions at the end of this that are over, you know, past that. I'd be happy to take care of that.
So. Great, terrific. Well, we talked about the health of the lakes. Are some lakes better than others for steelhead, per se? And if so, how would you rate them?
I guess that, you know, the lakes themselves or the fishing in those lakes would be characterized by, you know, the rivers themselves.
Right.
I think.
Would
so
like
I
produce,
think, yeah. I think all five are seeing enough fish that, you know, if you find a river that's kind of agreeable to you, then I think that's the key. You know, in terms of, you know, my focus and, you know, the things that I like out of a steelhead river are that it can produce, you know, wild fish. You know, generally that it, you know, has a fair amount of distance to it. I mean, some of my favorite rivers have either no dam on them or, you know, the dam, if it does, is, you know, somewhere high on the, you know, on the river system. So certainly, you know, there's a number of rivers in the Michigan, you know, area, both that run into Lake Huron, but particularly those that run into Lake Michigan that kind of, you know, meet that. So, I mean, I kind of, you know, I've always looked at that area as, you know, one of the prime places to focus for quality steelhead experience. But Lake Erie is also, you know, over the years has probably generated the most number of fish. And so, you know, that, again, that area for me, you know, represents probably the best opportunity to catch, you know, numbers of fish. And like I said, we refer to this section of the lower part of Lake Erie as Steelhead Alley. So that's a number of probably 20-some rivers that run out of, you know, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York. You know, Lake Superior offers, you know, maybe the fish are a bit smaller up there because it's further north, the growing season is shorter, but it represents some of the, you know, most pristine fishing in the Great Lakes, represents an opportunity to really find a wilderness experience. So that's kind of the character of that lake. Lake Ontario, you know, the lake that I probably, you know, fish the most in terms of tributaries, it has long been known for, you know, producing some of the bigger fish in the Great Lakes. And I think that's still true. I mean, I think there's still the best chance of catching an exceptional size fish probably comes out of Lake Ontario. Even though I don't know the numbers there, again, aren't what they once were, it still, you know, is producing a significant number of fish and, you know, this ability to catch some bigger fish. So I guess, you know, from that standpoint, each of the lakes kind of has, you know, in each parts of the lakes kind of have some, you know, some advantages and some points that I think, you know, provide a unique experience.
Okay, great. What are the, consider some of the more famous rivers for steelhead along any of the lakes? Doesn't matter which.
Yeah, I guess, you know, and I think, again, that Michigan area along the western coast of the lower peninsula. So, you know, I'd look at, like, the Pere Marquette is one that has a rich history and just a beautiful river to steelhead fish, a little smaller than maybe I like. I like a little bigger river, but it just has all the character of a wild steelhead river. The Manistee and the Muskegon in Michigan as well. I think those all kind of rate as, you know, some of the top rivers, at least in that area and, you know, and throughout the great, you know, some of the better, you know, rivers in the Great Lakes. And then maybe I would look at, you know, in Wisconsin, there's a river called the Brule River. And you know, again, that's, you know, fairly wilderness type river that has natural reproduction. You know, a totally wild population of steelhead. So that's certainly a top-notch river. if you look at the North Shore, Lake Superior, there's just a number of rivers up there, but, you know, a couple that I guess would come to mind would be like the Nipigon and the Pancake River, again, providing just, you know, near wilderness experiences.
Are those coming off the North Shore or the South Shore?
They are. Those are coming off the North Shore of Superior, yeah, in Ontario. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So up past Boundary Waters.
Yeah, pretty good hike, you know, pretty good drive. I mean, it's certainly up there, you know, Thunder Bay area as a, you know, point of reference.
Yeah.
You know, then in, you know, the Steelhead Alley, you know, that there's a, just really, again, a handful of rivers, but, or even more than a handful, 20-some rivers, but the ones that kind of stick out there would be the Grand River and Conneaut River in Ohio, the Elk Creek in Pennsylvania, the Cattaraugus Creek in New York State. Those would be kind of the top, you know, rivers there. I also spend a fair amount of time up in Ontario, you know, rivers that are flowing into, you know, Lake Erie, Lake Superior, or Lake Erie, Lake Huron, and Lake Ontario. And, you know, it's probably the most notable rivers there in that area would be, you know, the Grand River, which, you know, is producing a really good population of wild fish, the Saugeen River, the Maitland River, the Ganaraska River, which runs into Lake Ontario. So those are certainly notable rivers in that area. And then in, you know, my home state, you know, I mentioned the Cattaraugus, but I spent a fair amount of time on the Niagara River, which is a, you know, huge piece of water, but, you know, is a challenging piece and, you know, someplace that I really love to fish. And probably the, you know, the most famous of the, you know, the Great Lakes rivers, at least in the eastern end of the lakes, is the Salmon River. And that runs into Lake Huron, or Lake Ontario by the town of Pulaski in New York State. And, you know, it's a beautiful river. It receives a lot of fishing pressure. You know, it's really as famous for its fishing pressure as it is for its fish, but at the same time, it can provide a, you know, high quality experience.
Yeah, great, great. Lots of places to fish. That's
yeah, there are. And I mean, those really are just the highlights. I mean, there's a number of other rivers that, you know, that would meet pretty much anybody's, you know, definition of quality fishing. So there's, you know, that's, you know, the top 10 or 12. I mean, there's another 40 or 50 that, you know, provide good fly fishing.
A couple of questions specifically about places to fish. Steve in Colorado Springs says, have any near steelhead fishing near Grand Rapids? Said his daughter goes to college there. He thought it would be a good father-daughter outing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any guide recommendations there?
Absolutely. I mean, that, you know, the Grand Rapids area, right, you know, the Grand River is right there. There's a smaller little river called the Rogue River. But I would, you know, heavily recommend towards, you know, going up a little bit north and going up to the Muskegon. And, you know, I think that's, you know, one of the top quality, you know, steelhead rivers in the Great Lakes. Guide recommendation, let's see, there's you know, two things I would say. There's a shop in Grand Rapids, Great Lakes Fly Fishing Company. And, or a guide that, a good friend of mine guides on the Muskegon, that's Kevin Feenstra. And that's F-E-E-N-S-T-R-A. And, it's Feenstra Guide Service. He has a website.
Great, great. Yeah. Another question from Mike in, Pearland, Texas. Primarily fishes in salt water and warm water in Texas. Where would you recommend, for a first trip for Great Lakes steelhead? After all those rivers.
Yeah, you know, historically I would, if somebody's coming to catch their first fish or attempt to catch their first fish, I think the Steelhead Alley area and in the lower part of Lake Erie has traditionally been probably the best place to do that just because of the number of fish that are available there. And, you know, and there's a pretty wide range, you know, of rivers there in terms of size and water flow, so that usually something along that stretch of road is, you know, it's really the Route 90, you know, Interstate 90 goes right along there. Something along there is usually fishable and has some steelhead in it. So,
And when you say Steelhead Alley, so are you talking south of Erie or north? Erie.
Yeah, this would be the southern shore of Lake Erie.
Between Cleveland and
Yeah. Basically, okay. Cleveland, including Cleveland. So, I mean, Cleveland and, you know, slightly west of Cleveland. And, you know, all the way back to Buffalo.
Wow. Okay. So that whole shore. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And probably the best bet is start researching that area and look for a guide or shop to
Yeah, and there's the you know, there's yep. there exactly there's shops in Buffalo, shops in Cleveland. You know, there's a guy, you know, there's again a guide service that you know, the individual that I work with here, Cattaraugus Creek Outfitters, and you know, he Vince Tobia, he fishes all through New York. There's a guide service called Steelhead Alley Guide Service, and that you know, they service really that whole area. So those would be some thoughts. But that would be, you know, for a number standpoint, opportunities. Again, I would, you know, for quality of fishing, you know, Ontario and again, that Michigan shoreline also offers some great fishing. And there's some great fishing in Wisconsin too, you know, in terms of along the Lake Michigan shoreline there and, a little more stocked fish on that side, but. Yeah, you know, so those are okay. Yeah, those would all be recommendations I'd say to look for to start.
What's the season for steelhead? I'm assuming it changes from north to south, lake to lake, but is there a general?
Yeah, it does. You know, the rundown on you know, the timing of the year would be you know, generally this. I mean, what we have in the Great Lakes for the most part are referred to as winter run fish. So they begin their migration up the rivers the preceding, you know, fall. So again, what a steelhead is, it's no different than the steelhead on the West Coast. They're a migratory fish living most of their life in the lake, moving up into the river, you know, mainly for the purpose of spawning. And so with these fish, for the most part, they begin their, you know, ascent into the rivers in the fall. October and November is usually prime nonce. You know, I would say, I mean, a step back, October through usually the mid to end part of December would be the prime months for steelhead fishing in the Great Lakes. And, you know, that's when you're going to find, you know, the most number of rivers that have fish in them. You know, that's the time when the water temperatures are going to be, you know, generally at their best, you know, for finding aggressive fish. It's also the time when you're going to, you know, be intercepting fish that have just spent a whole summer in the lake or in you know, are in prime shape in terms of, you know, how aggressive they are and how well they fight and things of that nature. So that's really my favorite time, that, you know, October to December. But as you mentioned though, Roger, there is some variation from lake to lake and variation from river to river. And you know, even one of the rivers I've mentioned, this Cattaraugus Creek in New York, and if we get cool weather, you know, we'll see some steelhead showing up there in early to mid September some years. So it can start.
So again,
that
the
early.
Best thing is call a local shop and find out what they think.
Right. And generally the cooler, when you get these cooler late summers, you can expect to start to see some steelhead in September if it's warmer and low water and you know, not getting much rain, you know, then it usually pushes it back a little bit.
Let's talk about a little bit more about steelhead themselves. Bob in Rhode Island asked about whether the Great Lakes steelhead are a different species than the sea run steelhead on the West Coast.
And it's really a great question, and you know, there obviously has been there's been a much debate about this in magazines and websites and, you know, shows I've been to, and, you know, I certainly, you know, I think West Coast steelheaders generally would look at a Great Lake steelhead, I guess, as being a bit inferior to the, you know, the native fish. I can kind of understand that point, that they're not native to the Great Lakes, and they're not making the switch from saltwater to freshwater like a Pacific fish does, but there seems to be no, you know, physical difference between a steelhead in the Great Lakes and a steelhead in the West Coast. I've actually, a biologist that, you know, I did some work with respect to, you know, this book, at least in terms of just running different, you know, ideas, you know, by him. His name is John George. He's a biologist for the Ministry of Natural Resources in Ontario, mainly up in the Lake Superior area. And he's done some extensive studies, and you know, there's just no physical difference that he's been able to observe, you know, through his you know, through his work, between a West Coast fish and a Great Lakes fish. And there's no no physical difference because of, you know, them not going through this change from saltwater to freshwater. I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's not like a West Coast fish has an extra part or an extra organ or anything like that. I mean, there's just no difference.
What about the actual strength of the fish? You fished for both. You find that they're just as strong in the Great Lakes as they are coming out of the sea?
You know, a wild fish in the Great Lakes that's in prime shape, you know, I've experienced fish here that are every bit as strong as, you know, a fresh wild fish, you know, out west. You know, with some exceptions, I've fished on a couple of rivers in British Columbia where the fish have been exceptionally strong because in one situation it had, you know, those fish had to get over a falls at some point in their migration, and it seemed to kind of make them a bit of a super strain. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, I have encountered fish in the Great Lakes, again, that are in prime shape, wild fish that have put on every bit good of a show as, you know, a West Coast fish.
Are they just as difficult to catch coming out of the Great Lakes as they are in the North?
Yeah, I think they can be. It's a bit different because I think in the West Coast you don't have the densities of fish, but you also don't have the densities of anglers. So, I mean, it does create a, you know, I think they're both, in both places they're as easy or as difficult to catch, you know, depending on, you know, conditions. And I do think that, you know, the angling pressure in the Great Lakes, even though there's more fish, at the same time, you know, with more anglers, it creates a certain challenge that, you know, maybe, you know, maybe you hook a few more fish in the Great Lakes because there's greater density. But I think, you know, that fact that there's a little more fishing pressure, you know, creates a bit of a challenge in itself. So I think they're the similar fish. Same, you know, basically they react very similarly in the water, but, you know, this kind of the differences in the rivers and, you know, the fishing pressure, you know, has an impact.
Okay. Well, let's take another quick break here, and we'll be right back, talk a little bit more about steelhead, and then jump into equipment. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk-away and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. More information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Rick Kustich about Great Lakes steelhead. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And send us your question in the text box there on our homepage. We'll try to answer as many questions as possible on the show tonight. Okay, we do have a question about flies. We're going to get to flies here in just a minute, so we'll catch up with that in just a few minutes. Rick, difference between wild and hatchery steelhead?
Part of the difference is aesthetic. I mean, I think all, you know, anglers, particularly as we mature, you know, have an appreciation for fish that have been, you know, born and raised in the natural environment. And it's something special about those fish. I think it's an indicator of that river, you know, here in the Great Lakes, that it's a high water quality and, you know, a river deserving of, I guess a mature angler's attention when it can produce wild fish. But I guess more, you know, importantly, you know, well, let's just say that I think that, you know, wild fish tend to be a bit more aggressive, and I you know, personally feel like generally they fight better as well. And, you know, I think you kind of get just a more well-rounded, you know, experience from pursuing and catching wild steelhead.
And you can tell the difference looking at them right away?
Physically, the only way you can be sure that a fish is a wild fish or a hatchery fish is, you know, some type of a scale analysis. Although I think generally, you know, there are some of the states actually do some fin clipping of some of their fish. So you're able to tell if a hatchery fish, obviously, if it has a clip fin.
Right.
But on the opposite side of that, wild fish usually have fully developed fins, where hatchery fish will usually have some deformity in their fins. And a lot of that has to do with when they're growing in a pen. Usually their fins are rubbing up against other fish. They're rubbing up against the side of the pen, and there'll be some laying over deformity in the fins. So usually they're not as crisp and well defined as a wild fish's fins.
What about the size of the Great Lakes steelhead? Are they comparable to the West Coast as well?
Well, in some ways they are. I mean, the average size of a fish in the Great Lakes, I would say, is 5 to 7 pounds, 5 to 8 pounds. That's the average, on an annual basis. You know, catching fish 10 to 12 pounds in size is pretty common. Some fish exceeding that, 12 to 15 pounds, are seen each year. So, from that standpoint, it's comparable to some of the rivers out west. The one thing about out west, though, is there are a good number of rivers, particularly in British Columbia and even some in the lower 48, that just have strains of fish that produce larger varieties. So, yeah, there's much greater chance of catching a 20 pounder out in British Columbia than there is in the Great Lakes. So,
okay.
But as an average, it's pretty comparable.
Now, I also know that there are lake run browns that are quite popular in the Great Lakes. The strategies and techniques we talk about here in a few minutes about fishing for them, does any of that transfer over to the lake run browns, or is that a whole game?
Yeah, it really does. Every year I catch, a good number of, or I shouldn't say a good number, but certainly a number of lake run browns while I'm fishing for steelhead. So they'll take the same flies, the same, the same presentation. Although I think, particularly in the fall, I think you can do a little better on brown trout with more of a dead drift, approach, dead drifting egg patterns and nymph patterns and things like that. And I really don't fish that approach that much for steelhead. So, there's certainly a fair amount of overlap, where you can catch, maybe you'll catch a steelhead and the next fish will be a brown. So, yes, there certainly is that opportunity.
Okay. You spent a lot of time in your book on equipment. And you kind of talk about the three types of rods that you talked about in the book. And then maybe we can go through each one of them about its best use and so forth.
Yeah, basically, I'd say in the last 10 to 15 years, my own personal approach to steelheading has changed to the point where I fish almost entirely with a swung fly. And one of the things that accommodates that the best is to be able to, and I'll talk more, about this in a second, but, being able to spay fish and spay cast. So, I've developed a heavy reliance on using switch rods and two-handed rods. So, basically the three rods that, I kind of put in buckets in the book is a single-handed rod, a switch rod, and a full two-handed rod. The applications, I guess, are that I would use, a single-handed rod, and I really don't use them much anymore. If any, I can't remember the last time I've actually used a single, purely single-handed rod to steelhead fish. But generally, I would use them on smaller rivers and areas where, you know, you're mainly fishing small runs, small pockets, smaller pools and things of that nature, maybe doing more of a dead drift approach. But I guess, and there's certainly plenty of that type of water in the Great Lakes. There's as much as there are some really big rivers and good-sized pieces of water to fish, there's that many more that are just smaller, more intimate situations. So that's kind of where I would see the single-handed rod fitting the best is in those.
What size single-handed rod weight?
I always think that there's a certain amount of there's an advantage to length for purposes of line control. So I think a 10 foot, if you're going to use a single-handed rod, a 10 footer is the right length. Probably a 10 foot for a 7 is probably the best overall, Great Lake steelheading rod if you're going to use a single-hander. And as some of these, some rod manufacturers now have made rods lighter, they have been able to make single-handed rods that are 10.5 or even 11 feet. And, that extra length is all the better, as long as they're not too cumbersome to fish with all day.
And when you're fishing those smaller rivers, what do you find yourself using primarily for lines? Are you using floating, sinking tips? Sinking?
Yeah, generally, on smaller rivers, using a floating line, maybe a longer leader, 10 to 14 feet, weighted fly. Or, maybe instead of a long monofilament leader, using a weighted, one of those weighted leaders, and just a shorter, maybe 4 foot piece of monofilament tippet.
Okay. And then your next step up would be to the switch rods.
Yeah. So basically, what the switch rod does is it's really, it gets its name from the fact that you can switch back and forth between using it as a two-handed rod, usually light enough that it can be cast and fished with a single hand, even if it maybe not for all day, but certainly for a portion of the day. So it usually has, a typical switch rod has a little bit of an extended butt on the bottom so that you can two-hand cast, with your dominant hand generally on top and your other hand on down below on the lower grip. And again, it gives you the opportunity to spay cast on, smaller to medium sized rivers. Although with some of the lines that are available today and some of these switch rods, are becoming a bit more powerful. Even an 11 foot switch rod can cast significant distances with a spay cast. So. I think even from my own standpoint, I'm using a switch rod more and more just because, it's lighter. I enjoy the fight of the fish a little bit more on, a rod that's a little lighter and a little softer. And
so what
then,
size of those do you recommend?
Generally for a switch rod, they're generally 10.5 to, 11.5 feet in length. But I think, my rod that I kind of go to all the time is an 11-foot length. And, it's built for an 8-weight line. But, the whole concept of, the line weights has really gravitated towards more looking at what your total grain weight of your head that you're casting, that you're spay casting. So, my typical, switch rod would be one that would be, an 11 foot long rod that generally matches up with about a 450 grain, Skagit type head. So that's really a pretty versatile, setup for fishing, smaller rivers, medium sized rivers.
You want to explain to folks if they're not familiar with what a Skagit head is?
So basically, in terms of spay lines and spay casting lines, I would look at there being kind of three different types of lines. One would be a longer belly type of line that has more of a typical weight forward taper to it. Generally, those lines have a, you know, a full head that either loops on or is constructed to a running line. You know, so maybe the entire length of the line is going to be 110 feet or something like that. But the head, the thicker part of the line is probably only going to be about 50 to 55 feet in length. And usually you're going to cast the head past the tip of the line, past the tip of the rod. But what's become more common in recent years are shorter heads and heads that have a little bit more mass to them. When you're spay casting, they allow you to form a much shorter D-loop when you're actually making your cast. Allows you to cast in more tighter situations because you don't have to have much line go behind your casting position. But I think one of the advantages of it is that it has these shorter heads anyways, is that they have shortened the learning curve for spay casting and have made it much easier for, you know, beginners to just pick up a spay rod and you know, be able to both enjoy and use them as a fishing tool. But there's three different types of spay lines. You got this longer belly type of line. You have a line that's called what's referred to as a Scandinavian head or a Scandi head. And so it's a shorter head, but it has a fairly long taper to it. Generally, those heads will be 35 to 40 feet in length, so a little bit shorter than your mid-size head, but able to deliver long casts with a lot of line speed. But they don't handle heavier sink tips or heavy flies very well, so they'll handle sinking leaders and lightly weighted flies. But a line type that was developed on a river in Washington called the Skagit River is even shorter yet. Generally, these lines are anywhere from 28 to 35 feet, and even shorter for switch rods. But they have a lot of mass to them in that short area. And they're that shorter length, and they're able to propel heavier flies, heavier tips, and cast really long distances. And again, really make it easy for beginners to kind of pick up the rod and be able to make a, you know, reasonable cast with the rod. So that's kind of what that is. It's just a short head, short compact head that has a lot of mass, develops a lot of line speed when you cast, and able to handle heavy sink tips and heavy flies, so it makes it a very versatile tool when you're steelhead fishing.
We did have a question from Malcolm in Ontario, and he was asking what the ideal weight rod for a beginner would be. And he said he'd heard 11-foot 7 weight. That's real close to what you were just talking about, that switch rod, 11, 8-foot, right?
Yeah, I think, yeah, exactly. I do think that, if you're going to a switch rod, you know, something that, and the nice thing about a switch rod is that if you're kind of just getting into steelhead fishing, you still want to fish a dead drift technique with a long leader, you know, it allows you to do that. It gives you the length and rod control, the line control to do that, but it also allows you to, spay cast. So yeah, something, if you're looking for a switch rod, something about 11 feet, something that handles, an 8-weight or a, 450 grain Skagit head would be a really good starting place.
Okay. Any recommendation for reels? Anything specific?
And just to jump, real quick, Roger, so then the other third thing would be full two-handed rods. And, and those rods, they're too long and cumbersome to handle with one hand. But, those rods, again, as these lines that we're casting and these heads that we're casting are becoming shorter, the rods have become shorter as well. So when I first got into, spay fishing, again, 15, 20 years ago, we were casting 15-foot rods and, long heads. Now the rods have gotten shorter, lighter. So generally 12 to 13 foot rods are what we're using on even on the largest of rivers. And with these shorter heads, you're able to attain significant casting distances. I mean, it's not uncommon for a fishing caster to be able to, you know, cast 90 to 100 to 110 feet of line, you know, with one of these 12 to 13 foot rods.
Okay. Okay. So anything to say about reels?
You know, I think that the key things with reels are steelhead are really known for their, you know, their quick start and stop fighting ability. So the one thing that I think is critical to a good steelhead reel is something that has a drag that has very little or, you know, if any startup inertia when a fish goes to run. You know, I've even gone to, more of a click type drag for most of my steelhead fishing. I mean, you generally, unless you're fishing in some confined area, you know, I like to kind of keep my drag light anyways. So, you know, that type of a reel really kind of accommodates that. The other key element to a reel though is just that it balances out your system. And, it's really key with, spey fishing. Is in, you know, and this, you know, the wet fly swing technique, that your rod isn't either, you know, too heavy to the butt side or too heavy to the tip side, and you really want to be able to grab your rod, you know, at the cork, and it should be fairly balanced with, you know, the line out into the water. So you know, the weight of that reel will have an impact on that. So you really want something that balances with the rod. If it, you know, I've had the situation where I've had, you know, outfits that have been a little tip heavy, and it really creates a lot of strain on your arm and wrist all day. You wouldn't think about it, but holding it for, you know, 8-10 hours of fishing, and you're kind of constantly fighting it being tip heavy,
yeah.
You know, it creates a lot of strain in your arm.
You did talk about leaders and tippets a few minutes ago, and about adjusting the length depending on what kind of lines you were using as well. Any other comments on that?
Well, I think just, you know, the key thing is when you're using a dead drift technique, you're going to generally use a longer, you know, 10 to 14 foot leader, and usually a little, you know, little lighter tippet to, you know, allow the fish to get a more of a dead drift. So maybe, you know, 1X, 2X, or even 3X tippet. But when I, you know, my preferred manner for fishing for steelhead is to use the wet fly swing, you know, allowing that, you know, fly to swing across the water. You know, the fish is generally going to take the fly from behind, turn on the fly, you know, turn down river. So you need a, you know, pretty significant strength to your tippet to be able to withstand that take generally. So when I'm using the wet fly swing technique, I'm usually using either a sinking leader or a, you know, a full sink tip, you know, 10 to 15 foot sink tip. And then my monofilament portion of that goes down to the fly would probably be about 4 feet in length generally, although sometimes I'll go longer in clear water, but it's about 4 feet in length. And, I usually taper that from a 15 foot piece that goes to the tip down to a 12 or a 15 pound piece of monofilament that goes, you know, looped onto the tip, and then a 12 pound piece that goes down to the fly itself. Steelhead anglers here in the Great Lakes that are used to dead drifting generally use much lighter tippet and sometimes have a more difficult time adjusting to you know, the idea of using such a heavy tippet for a steelhead. But with the wet fly swing, that fish is just kind of, again, taking the fly from the side or from the rear and never really sees the tippet and really doesn't really come into play. So,
okay.
You know, the strength, I hate breaking fish off, so I always want to make sure I have significant strength.
Yeah, you've worked so hard to get them on.
Exactly.
Well, let's just jump. I was going to ask you some questions about spey casting, but we're running short of time and I want to get into fly strategy, so we'll save that for another day. But so let's talk a little bit about flies. You dedicated a large section to flies in your book, And I guess I was kind of surprised. And can you kind of break down the different, you know, if you can categorize them? And I guess I was surprised, and I just thought there would be less flies that you'd have to deal with. And so I've got my curiosity up. So can you kind of break them down into different styles or sizes or however you would arrange them in your box?
Yeah, and, you know, you make a good observation because, you know, I think from a, you know, my general philosophy from flies for steelhead is this. They're probably overrated in terms of, you know, how many you really need. And, you know, I think a lot of it is, you know, certainly patterns work better on a particular river because of the color, or maybe they represent a natural bait on that river. But, you know, generally I think a steelhead would, you know, any given steelhead, if you made a good presentation to it, would react to, you know, a number of different flies, you know, if it's presented properly. So to me, presentation and you know, strategy is clearly more important than the fly. I think the fly really is something that each steelhead angler just needs to really develop his own, you know, confidence patterns and a handful of confidence patterns that really work, you know, on the rivers that they fish. So I think that's really the key thing from my standpoint. You know, I have really a handful of flies that I fish both in the Great Lakes and the West Coast. I really don't, you know, put too much emphasis on or too much pressure on having the right fly, because I, you know, I've developed confidence in a number of them, and really just don't want to spend a lot of time switching flies and want to just make sure that I'm covering the water, as opposed to spending a lot of time second guessing my fly selection. So, I mean, from that standpoint, my own box probably only has a variety of six flies in it. So, but I did want to try to get in the book a representative example of, you know, what some of the other, you know, experts and guides in the area are, you know, using as their confidence flies, and, you know, give the reader of the book, you know, the ability to kind of pick and choose some of those and develop their own confidence with those.
Yeah. Well, you've kind of, by looking, you know, you've broken them down here by the different anglers and what they use, like you said. And I guess looking at all the different kinds really kind of substantiates what you said about it may have more to do with the river you're on and your presentation than the actual fly itself. Because they're so wide and varied, I guess.
Right.
I'm getting at, you know,
yep, yeah. Exactly. They really are. But the one thing, I mean, to get back to your original question and you know, just try to break them down into some, you know, general, you know, categories. I guess the overall, you know, three categories that I would think about is, you know, you have subsurface flies that you're going to, and generally that's just real quick with Great Lake steelhead. I mean, you can catch them at any level of the water column, but, you know, generally the more consistently you work your fly in maybe that bottom foot of the water column, that, you know, the more, takes you're going to get. So basically, I guess I would think of flies in three different types. I mean, one would be the types that I'm going to use for the wet fly swing. And generally, those flies are going to have flies that have movement to them. And, you know, for the most part, I'm going to tie those out of rabbit strips or marabou or Arctic fox, things that when they're wet and in the water, they have a real seductive, you know, fishy movement to them. And then for dead drifting flies, you know, I would look at more natural food sources like nymphs and egg patterns and, you know, things like that. You know, those types of, you know, food sources that would be drifting naturally with the current. And then the third type would be just, you know, some dry flies, and I've included some of those in the book. And there's not a tremendous amount of opportunity to catch steelhead on the Great Lakes on dries, but there is the opportunity, and when it's there, you do want to be carrying a few flies for that situation.
So what do you consider then your, we had a couple of questions here about your go-to flies, and since you said you really have a handful that you use, can you tell us which ones those are? Describe?
Yeah, I mean, my one fly that I would probably fish just about anywhere on any river, and it's produced, you know, on the Great Lakes and the West Coast, is just a kind of a marabou, what I call a marabou stay fly, and it's just one that's a couple different colors of marabou just wrapped on the shank of the hook. And then just, I usually add some elements of flash to that and maybe, another hackle to kind of dress it up at the front. But in the last probably 5 to 10 years anyways, I've been fishing, I would say 10 years, tube flies almost exclusively for my steelhead flies. So instead of tying them on an actual shank of a hook, I'm tying them on a hollow tube. And basically what the tube allows you to do is place a short shank hook at the very rear of the fly, because when I'm swinging flies, steelhead have this real tendency to take just the rear of the fly or even just the very back of the fly into their mouth. And if you have your hook positioned at the rear of the fly, you're going to get more hookups. Also with the tube fly, I'm able to use a very short shank hook, which seems to allow for a greater landing percentage of the fish that you do hook. So that would be one of my go-to flies, would be marabou type of spay fly tied on a tube.
Okay, pretty simple.
Yep. And and then again, rabbit type flies. I have this one called a bunny spay. It's kind of an extension of a zonker pattern. And again, I tie it mainly on a tube fly. And, that has been one of my, my top producers over the years.
I noticed that picture. Yeah, that hook or stinger is way in the back there. Picture there.
Exactly.
Real apparent. What's the length of that bunny fly? Because that was a question one of them had. It's the common length fly that you use.
Yeah, generally I'd say they're, 2 to 3 inches in length. But, we've caught some fish on flies that have been, 4 to 5 inches long over the years. But I would say that, that 2.5-3 inch length is pretty typical.
And comfortable enough to cast, too, as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I'm not too big to handle.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the, let's talk about strategies here a little bit. You had mentioned earlier that to get the steelhead actually running, and that's going to be different. It's primarily temperature more than anything.
I would say probably even more than temperature. That's one of the characteristics, particularly in the fall. I mean, if the water's too warm, they tend to hold off. But I think the other key factor is water flow. So as the rains come in the fall and the water rises. That's one thing that always is going, especially if it rises and dirties, that's something that always seems to bring fish in from the lake. Yeah.
Okay.
The one thing I didn't mention before too, Roger, just real quick, and we would talk more about fall fishing before when you asked about the best time. I mean, steelhead are going to be found in the rivers all through the winter as well. They're just not quite as active. You don't have fish moving in, as regularly as you do in the fall. But there be the opportunities to fish for steelhead throughout the winter. And then again, it kind of picks up again in the spring, because that's the time of year when they actually spawn. So it's going to
be. Yeah, what Trey Going in Idaho was asking here on the Internet. He wrote in and said, is there an A run and B run like on the West? Would that be your A and B run, so to speak?
Yeah, not per se, although there are rivers that, especially some of the longer rivers, that do have, they do have fish that are being generated out of one tributary versus another tributary, and some of those fish do have different characteristics and different run times. So, if that makes any sense,
okay.
So there are sometimes, differentiating characteristics in those fish.
What's the best way to find the fish in the river? Where do you look for them?
In the fall, I look for, particularly in the water temperature. So you mentioned water temperature. Water temperature is still critical. I mean, when the water temperature is from maybe 40 to 58 degrees, that's the prime time. And really, you can find steelhead if they're on the move. the water's up a little bit from, you know, from a recent rain. I mean, fish can be just, you know, quite literally everywhere in a river. You know, I'm going to still focus mainly on pools and, you know, the heads of pools and, you know, the tail outs if they have boulders and structure and things of that nature. But even some of the really quick, faster water, particularly if there's a fair amount of fishing pressure at that time of year in the fall, you know, that I'll focus on that as well. When I get into the winter time, though, as the water temperatures drop into the 30s, you know, fish can still be fairly active. They won't be as aggressive as they are in the fall, but I'll really start to focus more on really the slowest water at that time. You know, the fish really seem to congregate in, you know, some of the slow pools, you know, the areas where I can really fish my fly deep and slow as well. And then in the springtime, there'll be, you know, some fish that are, you know, I clearly stay away from fishing to any active spawning fish, and certainly something that I believe strongly in. But fishing, you know, the pools, you know, below, you know, the gravel, the areas in a river, you know, can produce fish that are, you know, coming up or dropping back down after the spawn. So that's, you know, another place where I kind of focus in the springtime.
Is there a difference in when fish strike more often, you know, when they're moving or they're holding? Does that make any difference, do you think?
Yeah, I think fish that are kind of holding and comfortable in a pool tend to be fish that will take the best. You know, fish that are on the move sometimes have that in their mind, that, you know, that kind of that migration. And, I mean, you can get those fish sometimes, and you can even see them sometimes on the move as they kind of roll and porpoise through a pool. But I do think that, you know, fish that are kind of holding and comfortable in a pool are, tend to be the, you know, the most aggressive. Although fish that are on the move sometimes will be, you know, aggressive as well.
Don French wrote in from Indianapolis, and he wanted to know what's the best way to get down to the fish in the deep pools. Is it a technique or weight?
Yeah, part of it, I mean, it's both, I guess. You know, certainly using a proper sink tip, you know, something that has a sink rate that is going to drop the fly. You know, and a lot of that really comes through experience, learning, you know, what it takes to get down in a particular pool at a particular level of the river. But, you know, with some of the sink tips now, you know, that are, you know, referred to as T14 or even T17, you know, these tips are have the ability to really get great depths in a, you know, pretty fast order. So, you know, using the proper sink rate tip, usually in conjunction with a fly that's slightly weighted, so it kind of sinks at the same rate or even faster than the tip itself. So that's part of the equation to getting a fly deep. The other part is, you know, proper line management. So usually making a cast that's maybe just angled slightly upstream, not much, but just slightly upstream. Making a big mend at the beginning, or even using some stack mends that take the tension off the line right after you've made your cast, and that really allows a fly to reach its maximum depth.
Okay. Another question from Larry Hall in Indian River, Michigan. He said, I'd much rather catch a steelhead on a swung fly than five under a bobber.
Right.
Spring can be a tough time to get the swung fly work. I always thought that swinging to drop back fish was the best way to get a hookup. Timing the drop back action has been tricky for me. Am I missing out by not swinging the dark water while active spawning is in progress?
Yeah, his first comment, I mean, that's how I feel as well. I mean, I certainly would rather catch one fish on a swung fly that, you know, kind of takes and grabs the fly, then that's really why I fish that way.
Sure.
You know, in entirely.
Why we all fish that way.
Yeah, no question. But, yeah. You know, in terms of, you know, targeting spring fishing, I mean, it goes back to one of the reasons I like fall fishing is that, you know, the fishing's a little bit more consistent. The mood of the fish is a little bit more consistent. It just changes all when you get close to the spawn. and the fish's mood and attitude just changes. So it does make spring fishing much trickier than it is in the fall. That being said, yes, I do think you should try to concentrate on some of that water that's in and around the dark water that is below gravelly areas. Again, really trying to make sure you're clearly staying clear of where they're spawning fish, but working on some of that water that may ambush some of the fish on their way up is certainly one strategy for the spring. In terms of fish that are dropping back down to the lake, they tend to be fairly aggressive in that they are trying to build their body weights back up, and one of the ways they do that is to feed on their way back down to the lake. So they can be aggressive fish in the spring. But just generally the fishing's with a swung fly or whatever technique is certainly trickier in the spring, just because the attitude of the fish is just, much more different than it is in the fall.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Rick, unfortunately, we've run out of time here. Many more questions to answer, that's for sure, but we'll have to cut it off here. Maybe we can have you back again and talk more about techniques and so forth.
Great.
But stick with me for a few more minutes here. We've got a few giveaways to do here, and, of course, give away your book as well, Advanced Fly Fishing for Great Lakes Steelhead, and also a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journals. So stick with us, folks, for just a couple more minutes, and we're going to give those prizes away. Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest run wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org to learn more about how you can get involved. Again, that's savebristolbay.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. Find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners of the drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And if you haven't registered yet, it's really too late to do that now. But make sure you do so for our next show, because we're always giving away some great prizes. Trying to get our database open here. So the first one, now if you are the winner, we'll contact you by email and get your information so that we can get these prizes out to you. The first prize we're going to give away is that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And I'll do a drawing here. Hold on just a second. Fly. Okay. Finally got it working. Looks like Tim Knight in Michigan. Great. Steelhead Country. Has won the one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So, Tim Knight, congratulations. And I know you'll enjoy the membership. If you already have one, we'll get it extended for you. If you haven't, or if you want to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, and they can take care of you there. And you'll learn much more about what a great organization it is to be part of. Now we'll give away that one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. And to learn more about what Amato has to offer, go to amatobooks.com. You'll find all kinds of fly fishing and other fishing books, as well as their periodicals. Our winner there is Charlie Nickel. Charlie Nickel in Maine. So, Charlie, congratulations. I know you'll enjoy that great magazine, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So, got those two. Just going to write them down here. Sorry, folks. So now let's give away Rick's book, Advanced Fly Fishing for Great Lakes Steelhead. And this is just a beautiful book, so whoever's the lucky winner will very much appreciate it. Let me clear my queue here. And, okay. So, question is, name one of the rivers that Rick mentioned earlier in the show. You got a bunch of selections there. And also tell me what the prime steelhead season is, what months. Two-part question. Name one of the rivers and what the prime steelhead season that Rick spoke of earlier. Okay, I got an answer here, but like a bunch of river names, but no season. So that one is not going to work for us. And Steelhead Alley, nope, we need a season. Cataragus, November to December. Don't think that was quite the season, was it, Rick?
Well, yeah, it's close.
Close, yeah.
Close.
Yeah. How about Muskegon in October to mid-December?
Yeah, I think that's a bell ringer there.
That's the one. Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of. Well, and it could have been many rivers, but the season was October to mid-December is the prime season. So Brian Fritterer, I think Brian's been on the show before, and I probably didn't pronounce your last name correctly, in Dayton, Ohio. So, Brian, congratulations. You're going to get a copy of Rick's book, Advanced Fly Fishing for Great Lake Steelhead. So congratulations. That was a tough one. We went through quite a few there trying to get that one right, so it wasn't as easy as it sounded. Okay, great. Well, thanks so much, Rick, for being on the show tonight. You did a great job. I really appreciate you spending your time and talking to us. Great to have you.
Well, it's great being here, Roger, and love to have another opportunity at some point to talk again.
Yeah. Maybe we can time it just before season next year and maybe just focus on tips and tricks of presentation or something like that. That would be great.
Okay. Sounds good.
Terrific. Well, hopefully everybody has found our archive on our website. If you haven't, look at the bottom of any page and look for the archive link. You'll find, I think we have now 167 shows that you can look at and listen to, anywhere from trout to tarpon and all kinds of rivers and lakes across the world. So go dig in there and learn about whatever you need to learn about. It's getting quite extensive. Our next broadcast will be on May 1st, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll interview Chester Allen. And our topic for this show will be fly fishing for sea-run cutthroat trout, a little different kind of sea-run trout. Chester has been fly fishing for sea-run cutthroat trout for over 15 years, so listen in to hear his secrets and strategies for chasing these beautiful and aggressive feeding cuts, including in-depth information on how to figure the tides and find the best beaches and how to rig for success. So see you then. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Front Range Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, Royal Gorge Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.